Welcome to episode 528 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. My name is Divine. In this episode, we're going to be continuing our series on the USMLE Step 2 CK Free 120. This is the most recent one on the USMLE website. And this is going to be part 9. Again, I'm trying to give a fairly detailed discussion of every single question in this series. We've done 65 questions so far. So we're on question 66. So let's go ahead and power up here a little bit. Okay, so question 66. Let's just, again, if you've missed any part of the series, I promise you this is a lot of very useful learning. But anyway, okay. A 75-year-old man is admitted to the hospital because of a 3-day history of fever. He has type 2 diabetes mellitus, hypertension, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. 1 year ago, he had a stroke with residual right lower extremity hemiparesis. Medications are amlodipine, tiotropium, metformin, glimepiride, lisinopril, and aspirin. He does not drink alcoholic beverages and has smoked one pack of cigarettes daily for 50 years. The patient is widowed, lives alone, and has 3 adult children. He is not in acute distress. He is 178 centimeters, that's 5 foot 10 inches tall, and weighs 82 kilograms, that's 180 pounds. His BMI is 26 kilograms per meter squared. Temperature is 39.2 degrees Celsius, that's 102.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Pulse is 110 per minute. Respirations are 22 per minute. And blood pressure is 150 over 90 millimeters of mercury. Pulse oximetry on room air shows an oxygen saturation of 96%. Scattered end expiratory wheezes are heard. There is dense hemiparesis of the right lower extremity. Appropriate therapy is initiated. And 3 days later, the patient's condition has improved. He's awake, alert, and conversing with one of his sons about current events. Temperature is 37.2 degrees Celsius. That's 99.0 degrees Fahrenheit. Pulse is 72 per minute, and blood pressure is 130 over 82 millimeters of mercury. Discharge plans are discussed with the patient, his son, the physician, and a physical therapist. The physical therapist says the patient will be best cared for in a nursing care facility. The patient acknowledges that a nursing facility would provide better care for him, but says he will prefer to remain at home with a visiting nurse. Once outside the patient's room, his son says, "I have his power of attorney. Don't listen to him. He needs to be in a nursing home." Which of the following is the most appropriate next step? Option A says, inform the son that the decision is the patient's to make, regardless of the medical team's recommendation. Option B says, reassure the son that the patient will be admitted to a nursing care facility in accordance with the physical therapist's recommendation. Option C says, refrain from making any decisions until a family meeting with the son and siblings is arranged to discuss the matter. Option D says, request psychiatric evaluation of the patient's mental competency. Option E says, request to review the legal documentation designating the son as having power of attorney. So what do you think? So in this question, we can clearly see that this patient seems to be pretty with it. And he's heard the physical therapist's recommendations, and he has voiced his decision. So we got to respect that. We have to respect patient autonomy. And it's not like this person is demented or they don't know what's going on, yada, 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 right? So option A is going to be the right answer. Patient's made a decision. He has voiced his decision. He wants to go home and be seen by a visiting nurse. So I'm going to do that. So I'm going to go with option A. Option B, let's see, reassure the son that the patient will be admitted to a nursing care facility. In accordance, no, you're not respecting patient's autonomy by doing option B. Option C says, refrain from making any decisions until a family meeting with the son and siblings is arranged to discuss the matter. You don't need a family meeting. This guy's gotten better. It's not like he's checking into hospice or whatever. Nah, that's wrong, right? This is a simple question. You got to respect patient autonomy. Option D says, request psychiatric evaluation. Nope, this person doesn't have any signs of being demented or having a mental health disorder. And then option E says, request to review the legal documentation designating the son as having power of attorney. This is a very great but very wrong answer. Because it may seem like, oh, let's check if the son is right. If the son is right, then yeah, we gotta let the son do what he gotta do. But no. See, let me tell you this. There are very few times on the USMLEs where a patient, you don't let them make their own decisions. Very, very few, right? If a patient is with it, even if they've signed a power of attorney or whatever, but they're still able to voice their own considerations, then you should always go with the patient's considerations. That is the honest truth. That is what the honest truth. Because I know some of you may be like, wow, Divine, what if this song was truly the power of attorney? It does not matter. The only time where a power of attorney is going to kick in is if the patient becomes incapacitated and is like, wow, the person is like out of it, or the person is on a ventilator, is unresponsive, and they need a decision. Then the power of attorney can kick in under those circumstances. That's a very subtle point, but it's a very, very important point to understand, right? Even if you have a power of attorney, even if you have a living will, blah, 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 you, the patients, the decisions and stuff you see in real time is going to count more than anything, right? Even option D is kind of a wrong answer. Option D is wrong, right? It says the patient's mental competency. Competency is not something that is determined by a physician. A physician determines capacity. Competency is determined by the courts, right? You're not a lawyer. You're a physician. Okay. All right. So just kind of make sure you see why 66A is clearly going to be correct. Okay, so let's go to question 67. So a 59-year-old man is brought to the emergency department because of a one-hour history of weakness of his left arm and leg and mild headache. All right. He says that when he was gardening with his wife, he suddenly became unable to hold his gardening tool, lift his left arm, or walk. 2 weeks ago, he had a non-productive cough and nasal congestion that resolves spontaneously after 1 week. He has hypertension treated with lisinopril. On arrival, he is lethargic. He's 183 centimeters, so that's 6 foot tall, and weighs 97 kilograms, that's 215 pounds. BMI is 29 kilograms per meter squared. Temperature is 36.6 degrees Celsius, that's 97.9 degrees Fahrenheit. Pulse is 94 per minute. Respiration is 16 per minute, and blood pressure is 174 over 109. Makes sense. It's having a stroke. The pupils measure 3 millimeters and are reactive to light. Muscle movement is decreased over the left lower aspect of the face. Muscle strength is 0 out of 5 in the left extremities. Deep tendon reflexes are absent in the left extremities and 2+ in the right extremities. CT scan of the head shows a large area of increased attenuation in the right putamen region. Which of the following is the most likely cause of this patient's condition? All right, let's look at the answers. Option E says amyloid angiopathy. Option B says embolism. Option C says small vessel disease. Option D says vasculitis. Option E says venous thrombosis. All right, so what do you think? Right, this is a very good example of knowing your concepts, being able to make integrations, understanding pathophysiology, and being a test taker, just all merge perfectly into helping a person answer a question correctly, right? So, like, for example, we know this person has a stroke. That's a given. Now, what kind of stroke is this? Is it a cortical stroke or a subcortical stroke? This is a subcortical stroke. And the way you know that this is a subcortical stroke is that the person's upper and lower extremities are affected at the same time, right? That's one of the dead giveaways to tell yourself that, oh, gee, wait, this is a subcortical stroke versus a cortical stroke. A cortical stroke is a stroke in the cortex. When you have a cortical stroke, you're going to respect cerebral artery distributions. I'm going to say that again. Whenever you have a cortical stroke, you're going to respect what? Cerebral artery distributions, right? So, like, for example, if you're dealing with the middle cerebral artery, you're going to have issues with your upper extremities and your face. If you're dealing with the anterior cerebral artery, you're going to be dealing with your lower extremities, right? But this person has paralysis of the left upper extremities, the left lower extremities. Yeah, they have some face thing going on, whatever. Don't really care too much about that. But their left upper extremities, their left lower extremities are affected. Whenever you see the upper extremities and the lower extremities on the same side affected, that person does not have a cortical stroke. The person has a subcortical stroke. Because the thing is, once you dip below the cortex, the fibers for the upper and the lower extremities, they co-locate. It's almost like they are separated. It's almost like being single before you get married. In the cortex, the ACA, you know, does lower extremities. MCA does upper extremities and face. They're single then. But once you go below the cortex, you've dated for a long while. Now it's time to get married. So since they've gotten married, everything is kind of mixed together once you go below the cortex. So that's why you'll notice that, wow, when you have a subcortical stroke, the upper extremities and the lower extremities on that side are going to be affected, right? Usually it's going to be contralateral to the stroke, right? Because remember, those corticospinal tract fibers cross, right? So this person And usually subcortical strokes, we're going to find in people that have hypertension. We're going to find in people that have hypertension, right? We're going to find in people that have hypertension. Remember, hypertension is the biggest risk factor for strokes, right? Because when you have hypertension, you can develop these Charcot-Bouchard microaneurysms. And those microaneurysms, they can pop. And when they pop, right, that can cause a brain bleed, as we see on imaging in this patient, right? It says large area of increased attenuation. What do you think that increased attenuation is? That's blood, right? In the right putamen region. That tells us again that this is what? These are subcortical stroke. These are subcortical stroke. So those Charcot-Bouchard microaneurysms, look at the word micro, right? It's usually from small vessels. So the answer is going to be option C. But let's look at the other answers, because I don't want people to just say, oh, divine, you're just saying option C is right. Let's look at the other answers. Option A, amyloid angiopathy is wrong. Amyloid angiopathy, we usually find it in people that have Alzheimer's or people that have Down syndrome, right? They can get brain bleeds as a result of that, right? They can get brain bleeds as a result of that, because if you have excess amyloid, right, that amyloid can deposit in the walls of your cerebral vessels. And when it deposits in those walls, it makes those vessel walls weaker. And when they're weaker, they're going to pop. When they pop, you're going to bleed in your brain, right? But this person does not have Alzheimer's. This person doesn't have Down syndrome. Remember, Down syndrome, they have a ton of amyloid because they have three copies of the gene that codes for amyloid precursor protein. Embolism, usually we're going to find that in a person that has AFib or a recent MI. Right? AFib or recent MI, and then because their heart is not contracting properly, they have blood stasis. Remember, varicose triad. They have blood stasis, and that blood stasis is going to make them hypercoagulable, right? And they're going to make an embolus in the heart, and then it'll flick up to the brain. We don't see that here. So I'm not going to pick that. Option D says vasculitis. Vasculitis is going to be a chronic process, right? That makes no sense here. Option E says venous thrombosis, right? Again, it's highly unlikely that venous thrombosis will cause these kinds of things. You know, you can maybe think of cavernous sinus thrombosis. That's like a very classic venous thrombosis they love to test on the exams. But cavernous sinus thrombosis is going to cause a lot of extraocular muscle problems, because a lot of the cranial nerves that code for the extraocular muscles, that supply the extraocular muscles, they pass through the cavernous sinus. We don't really see that here. That's not going to be the right answer. Okay, now question 68 says, a 24-year-old premigravid woman at 10 weeks gestation comes to the office for a scheduled dilatation and suction curettage. Boy, I hate when people use the word dilatation. It's dilation, but dilatation is right, but I don't know, it just kind of goes under my skin a little bit. But anyway, right? So for the scheduled dilation and suction curettage, all right, ultrasonography 2 days ago showed a fetus consistent in size with a 9-week gestation with absent cardiac activity. Oh, that's not good. 2 weeks ago, the patient had an upper respiratory tract infection that resolved spontaneously. 1 year ago, she was diagnosed with herpes simplex virus 2, HSV2. Her last outbreak was 6 months ago. She has no other history of serious illness. She's 163 centimeters, that's 5'4" tall. She weighed 82 kilograms, that's 180 pounds prior to her pregnancy. BMI was 31 kilograms per meter squared. She has had a 3.6 kilogram, that's an 8-pound weight gain during her pregnancy. Vital signs are within normal limits. The vulvar area is shaven. No lesions are noted. Examination shows a normal appearing cervix. The uterus is non-tender and consistent in size with an 8-week gestation. A lot of stuff here seems pretty normal. But anyway, let's keep going. There's homogeneous white gray vaginal discharge. The pH of the discharge is 5.5. She undergoes dilation and suction curettage with sterile instruments and povidone iodine vaginal cleansing. Which of the following is the strongest predisposing risk factor for post-operative infection in this patient? All right. So option A says history of upper respiratory tract infection. Option B says HSV2. Option C says obesity. Option D says type of vaginal discharge. Option E says vulvar shaving. All right. So what do you think this is? These are the kinds of questions that cause people to scratch their heads, pull their hair out on the exam. You don't have to join any of those groups of people. Again, always just ask yourself, what is like really abnormal here? Because you probably heard me as I was reading the question that, man, a lot of this stuff is normal. Like, this person unfortunately had an intrauterine fetal demise. The baby's dead. We're bringing out the baby. Right? But they're asking, which of the following is the strongest predisposing risk factor for post-op infection? So we just need to ask ourselves, man, is there anything that is really abnormal in this lady that can cause problems? Well, let's look at some of these things. History of upper respiratory tract infection. That's not abnormal. She had this upper respiratory tract infection 2 weeks ago. It's cleared. She doesn't have it now. That's not going to be causing problems. HSV2. Her last outbreak was 6 months ago. It's not causing any issues now, so no. Option C says obesity. Okay, obesity may raise her risk, so let's maybe keep that for now. Option D says type of vaginal discharge. Well, the pH of the discharge is 5. Oh, okay, so that's not normal, right? So wait, hang on. So vaginal pH of 5.5 is not normal. It is not normal, honestly. It's not normal. Once your vaginal pH start dipping into the fives, that is not normal. That is absolutely not normal. In fact, actually, let's look at the discharge. It says white gray vaginal discharge. Oh, I wonder what that is. Let's see if you're thinking along with me here. What do you think? White gray vaginal discharge, and the pH is much greater than 4.5. What do you think that is? This woman has bacterial vaginosis. All right, so she's got bacterial vaginosis. That's like an actual infection. Okay, so that's not normal. All right, so I'm kind of thinking D. I like option D a lot. But let's look at option E, vulva shaving. You shave a person's vulva, you got to do surgery, you got to keep the area clean. So that's ridiculous, right? So, you know, I'll come between option C and D, but option D makes sense. It's an actual, she literally has an infection going on. So I'm going to go to option D. Option C is kind of, because obesity kind of raises your risk of many bad things, you know. But it's not as strong as like an actual infection going on right now, right? So I'm going to go to option D here. All right. Oh, question 69. Oh, okay. This is a classic one. A 74-year-old woman comes to the clinic 2 days after the sudden onset of severe left foot pain. She has had difficulty walking during this time and has been using a cane. She has not sustained trauma to the foot. She has type 2 diabetes, mellitus, and hypertension. Medications are metformin, insulin glargine, hydrochlorothiazide, lisinopril, and atorvastatin. She typically wears support stockings because of lower leg swelling, but the foot pain has made it difficult for her to wear them recently. She's a traveling pastor and spends more than 4 hours daily in her car. She has been monogamous with her wife for the past 30 years. Blood pressure is 146 over 88 millimeters of mercury. All the vital signs are within normal limits. A photograph of the left great toe is shown. Great toe. I wonder what this is. No other abnormalities are noted. Hemoglobin A1C 7.4%. Serum creatinine concentration is 1.4 mg per deciliter. And serum uric acid concentration is 7.8 mg per deciliter. I know some of you may be wondering, Divine, is that normal or abnormal? I don't know. I guess I got to look at the table of values. But honestly, I don't care about the table of values. This is a pretty classic case. You really should not be getting these kinds of questions wrong on the exam. Results of serum electrolyte concentrations are within the reference ranges. Which of the following is the most likely diagnosis, right? Option A says cellulitis. B says gout. C says infected mucoid cyst. D says osteoarthritis. E says pseudogout. F says rheumatoid arthritis. Please, don't tell me that you're picking anything other than gout here. Right. Again, the picture is clearly gout, but even if you don't see the picture, great toe suddenly is hurting, right? And we see this person is taking a thiazide diuretic. Thiazides, they compete for the same transporters that help you excrete uric acid, right? So the transporters used to excrete thiazides from your body is also the same transporters that you can use to excrete uric acid. So guess what? When you're using thiazide diuretics or loop diuretics, it's going to raise your uric acid levels. It's going to cause you to have gout. This person has gout. There's no point literally discussing any of the other answers. The answer is gout, okay? Remember, gout, we treat it with NSAIDs. That's it. Gout is treated with NSAIDs. Simple as that. NSAIDs. If NSAIDs are not an answer or the person has a contraindication, you can go ahead and put the person on like steroids. All right, let's do one last question here. So question 70 says, a 47-year-old man comes to the office for a routine examination before beginning an exercise program. He feels well. He has a 25-year history of type 1 diabetes mellitus, a grade 1 out of 6, early peaking, systolic ejection murmur is heard best at the left third intercostal space. Sensation to light touch is mildly decreased over the toes. The remainder of the examination shows no abnormalities. An exercise stress test shows a 3 mm ST segment depression early in the test. The test does not produce any pain. Which of the following is the most likely diagnosis? Right? So option A says cardiomyopathy. Option B says congenital heart disease. Option C says coronary artery disease. Option D says valvular heart disease. Option E says normal cardiac findings. All right, so let's look at this. What do you think is going on here? I mean, this person in this question, let's look through it. He seems to have he's getting a stress test. And then this stress test shows an ST segment depression. Well, whenever a stress test is positive, it means that your coronary vessels are not great, right? So we're going to go with option C here. So we're going to go with option C, right? You know, option B doesn't make any sense. Congenital heart disease, if you want to detect congenital heart disease, I don't know, maybe do like an actual structural imaging test of the heart, like an echocardiogram. Valvular heart disease, again, if you're trying to work on valvular heart diseases, you're going to be doing an echocardiogram, not an exercise, not an EKG-based stress test, right? E says normal cardiac findings. No, ST depressions are not normal cardiac findings. Again, if you suspect the cardiomyopathy, you're going to be doing an EKG for that. You're going to be doing an echocardiogram for that. And this person also has diabetic neuropathy, so they should probably look into that as well. You know, all these diabetics, many times they'll have like this burning pins and needle sensation in their lower extremities. But just something to kind of keep at the back of your mind for exam. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. I won't lie, I would like to keep going on this like right now, but I have so many responsibilities to do, so I think I'm going to pause on this. But again, the next one, I'll try to make it where I cover more questions. So again, if you love the way I teach, you love the way I make integrations, you love the way I explain my reasoning, you love the way I explain pathophysiology, then you'll be interested in the classes I offer. I have a series of classes that are super helpful for step one to step three. For step one to step three, I have, starting on the 18th of this month, I have an MBME test taking strategies class. It's 2.5 hours long. I have a biostats class that's 4 hours long. I have a social sciences and ethics, quality improvement and healthcare systems class. That's 5 hours long. These classes are not lectures. If you're expecting lectures, wrong class for you. These classes are based on me discussing clinical scenarios, MBME style questions extensively. They're pretty much almost all scenarios. And then I'll have these useful charts that I discuss to really get some points across to you. And I'll help you make a lot of integrations. And then the week after that, starting on the 22nd, I have a 20-hour step two, step three class. And then in the first week in May, from May 1st to May 5th, I have a 25-hour step one class. Again, I think these classes are going to be super, super helpful for a lot of people. Many people have taken my classes, done extremely well on the exams. I've had people get even in the high 270s. I believe I've actually had 280s from my classes. So again, I think these classes are going to be super helpful to you. If you're interested, just shoot me an email through the website. I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and complex exams, and med school exams and shelf exams. And I help with ERAS applications, recommendation letters, personal statements, and things of that nature. And then I have these podcasts on Apple, Google, and Spotify. So check those out. I have a YouTube channel where I post the videos that I make. And then I would also say that I have another website called divineinterventionlifelessons.com. Every week, I post two podcasts, usually on Fridays and Sundays, where from a biblical perspective, I address a life lesson. The podcasts are about 10 minutes long. You really should check those out. So thank you for listening to me today. I will see you in episode 529, I guess. Well, God bless you. Bye for now. Thank you.